Thanks for listening to this podcast. I'm Bob Kinzel, co-host of Vermont Edition. Just wanted to let you know that this has been edited for brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A few weeks ago, we did a program about the new report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The report says the world is likely to see some of the more dire consequences of climate change earlier than scientists previously thought, and at a smaller degree of global temperature rise. When we did our show, it was stuffed to the gills with topics that really needed more exploration, and we promised to bite off smaller chunks in future shows. Well, this is one of those shows. Today, we're going to explore the question of the impact our diet has on climate change. The central question often posed is, should you stop eating meat, or at least massively cut back on meat consumption? But it's more complicated than just a simple yes or no. For one thing, it's not just meat, it's most animal products. So we're talking cheese, eggs, milk, etc. Also, it's not just the final food product itself, it's about the way the animals were grazed, what it takes to raise them, the kind of land being used, and how it's managed. And then we get to questions of practicality. How would it look to turn away from animal consumption? Could we do it in a quick turnaround kind of way? And what would be better? Joining us to go through all of this is Meredith Niles, professor in the Department of Nutrition and Food Sciences in the Food Systems Program at the University of Vermont. Professor Niles, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much, Jane.
So is there a simple answer to, should I stop eating meat? Should I go vegan?
There's not a simple answer, unfortunately. Like many of these challenges around climate change, there really isn't a single solution. So I'm excited that you're going to try to unpack some of this today. But really, there's a lot of things we have to think about. We have to think about diet, but I especially want to impart, we also have to think about food waste, which is also part of this conversation.
All right. So let's start with what the problem is. I don't know how we can solve the problem without knowing what it is. So what is the problem with agriculture and specifically with meat consumption and the way that animals are raised when it comes to global warming?
Sure. So when we look at global greenhouse gas emissions, what we see is that agriculture and associated land use changes, so deforestation from agriculture, are about 25% of global emissions. When you look at the whole food system, so you add in the transportation, the packaging, the processing, food waste, we're talking about almost a third of total greenhouse gas emissions. So to address our climate challenge, we obviously should be thinking about food systems.
And specifically animal raising, animal meat production. So I know it's not just meat. We're talking dairy here too, especially dairy and meat, but also, you know, all the other things. How much within that agriculture sector can be attributed specifically to non-vegan products?
Yeah, so livestock and animal products are around 75% of that agricultural total. But I do want to acknowledge that when we think about agriculture, we're also talking about fertilizer use and cropland management, as well as then issues within livestock production, how manure is managed, how animals are grazed and fed. So there's a lot of complicated factors. In fact, even rice production, for example, contributes to greenhouse gas emissions.
Some of the articles that I've been reading, both since the IPCC report came out, but also since a separate report specifically looking at eating animal products came out, is that the single biggest thing you, an individual, can do to limit your impact on the world is to stop eating animal products. Do you think that's true?
I think it's more complicated than that. I mean, I think if we look at the most recent IPCC report, their main message wasn't just stop eating animal products. Their main message was consumption, and we should be thinking about consumption across all spheres of our life. So that's how we consume energy, how we transport ourselves, our diet, our material consumptions, what we buy, what we wear. So I think consumption is the broader message here, but acknowledging that food is part of our consumption and something that we can think about to deal with our climate challenges, I think, is really important.
We got a note from Dick who says, does avoiding animal products mean we should cut back on milk too? Darn, I was just discovering grass-fed milk. So what should Dick do?
Yeah, so this one, I mean, this is where the complication comes in, right? And I think we also have to acknowledge nutrition in all of these discussions, right? So if you look at grass-fed products, they have frequently higher rates of good fats in them, for example.
And so Grass-fed animal products
in general, right? So they could be contributing to some of those good fats that we want in our diet. But the research that is out there does suggest that reducing animal product consumption can help us reduce our greenhouse gas emissions footprint. So that does include a variety of products, but this is particularly true for ruminant animals, so those would be livestock in particular. But the research is also, you know, a lot of this is really emerging. We don't have long-term data or information over many studies over many years to look at these things, and really a lot of that is starting to increase in the scientific literature in most recent years. So our information is getting better and better.
We also got a note from Dave who says, this is more than a little silly. If people won't adopt a vegetarian diet to improve their own health, they certainly aren't going to do it to slow global warming. So, I mean, are we having sort of a pointless conversation here, Professor?
Well, I think that's why we should broaden the conversation, because actually the recent research on sort of the human behavior component of this is really clear. The most people are not willing to change their diets more than about 30%. So, you know, a couple of meals a week might make a difference, but I think we have to acknowledge that for human behavior, most people aren't going to become vegan and vegetarian. And so we have to think about other options. And that's why I think food waste is a really important conversation as well.
Well, let's go to the food waste segment of that conversation. So, you know, I certainly am guilty of looking in my refrigerator and realizing, oh, shoot, I didn't make that thing that I was going to make. And now it's expired, you know, into the compost or into the trash. So what should we be doing to, I mean, obviously we know what we should be doing, but how do we get better at thinking about food waste? And it's not just individuals here either.
That's right. Yeah. So in the United States, what we're really focused on here is across the whole supply chain. So we talk about food loss, which is what's happening at the agricultural level. There's great organizations like Salvation Farms here in Vermont that have fantastic gleaning operations to try to reduce that waste.
But gleaning, for people who aren't familiar with gleaning, this is actually picking things from the field so they don't actually rot in the fields.
That's right. Things that might go unharvested or maybe not have the highest quality. They might not look exactly perfect, but they're still edible. So groups like Salvation Farms partake in those gleaning efforts. But here in the United States, actually, about 50% of our food waste is at the household level. And last year, colleagues of mine at UVM and the USDA, we actually published a study where we found the average American wastes about a pound of food per day at the household level. So we really do have to look in our own refrigerators, as you just said, Jane, and take a hard look at what we're doing and how we can change our behaviors. You know, from a greenhouse gas emissions standpoint, actually, if food waste was a country, it would have the third largest emissions in the entire world. So right behind China and the United States would be food waste. And that's why I think it's a really important part of this conversation.
That's kind of a nutso statistic.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if, let's say, sure, I waste some food, but I compost it so it goes right back into the soil. I'm doing my part, no problem, right?
Yeah, that's what a lot of my students say, too. So I think that obviously we should be, when we have food waste, we should be minimizing its input into the landfills where it converts into additional greenhouse gas emissions. So composting, feeding to animals, anaerobic digestion, all these options are fantastic. But if we really want to prevent the greenhouse gas emissions on the front end, on the production, the distribution, the transportation, we need to avoid food waste from happening at all.
Okay. You know, easier said than done, I suppose. So in terms of just practical steps to do that, just be more conscientious. You know, how do I make sure that the restaurant I'm going to or the grocery store that I often frequent is not also contributing to that food waste problem?
Sure. Well, here in Vermont, we actually do have a policy that's coming into play by 2020, where food waste has to be diverted from landfills. So there is increasing focus on that here in Vermont. You know, at the household level, I think there's a couple of simple things. First of all, there's some great apps out there. I encourage people to look on their app store for food waste. These are apps that help you repurpose leftovers, find new recipes. You know, nobody wants to eat the same thing for 5 days in a row. And also, you know, reminders about, I put this thing in the freezer, take it out in 3 months so it doesn't go bad. So there are some great apps out there that can help us, you know, understand some of these challenges. But some of this is meal planning. And I also want to impart, there's economics to this as well. You know, some of the studies on food waste have found that the average family of four could save $1,200 a year if they reduced their food waste and minimized it. So there's really benefits both for households and people as well as for the environment with our food waste reductions.
Let's go to Caroy, who's calling in from Starksboro. Hi, Caroy. Go right ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You're on. Go right ahead.
Okay. So I've made life choices. You might hear cows in the background. But I don't think it's quite as simple as people becoming vegan, vegetarian versus meat eaters. I think that, and I know that if you feed beef, their natural grass and browse finish diet, first of all, they're not experiencing the high indigestion that mass-produced industrial corn-fed beef do. And they also retain, because they're not basically becoming pre-diabetic before slaughter, they're keeping the same high omega-3s with the ratio of omega-6s as wild salmon without the heavy metals. So if people became, you know, super intentional about the quality of beef or the meat and how it's raised with respect, with a respectful, loving, care-filled life and a respectful death where they never experience fear or stress, we also don't have that corticosteroid release into their bodies, which, of course, if they're truly fully healthy, their health gets transferred to their consumer if they're treated.
So, Carol, I'm going to stop you because we're going to dive into that more, and I appreciate your perspective on this and want to add another one from Robin, who says, I'm wondering if we need to eliminate eating meat or if instead we should be drastically reducing the total volume and eliminating eating meat from CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations. My understanding, Robin says, is there is land that can produce meat but not vegetable crops because it's hilly or rocky, and furthermore, we would need the healthy manure from small-scale animal production for fertilizer. The manure from CAFOs is toxic, while the manure from small-scale animal farming is part of a whole food system. And Professor Niles, I want to come back to you, but before we do, let's bring in another voice here. Seth Itzkan is co-founder and co-director of Soil for Climate, a Vermont-based nonprofit advocating for soil restoration to reverse global warming. And Seth, it's nice to have you on the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
So we're starting to go into this question of, is it about, you know, stopping our consumption of animal products, or is it thinking about how the whole process of how we get our food? And it sounds like it's both. Where do you come in on this?
It's definitely the latter. There are new forms of grazing management that offer profound hope for regenerative agriculture, which restores soil, captures carbon, replenishes watersheds, and creates a clean and safe climate future. We call this holistic plan grazing, or it's also called adaptive multi-paddock or AMP grazing in the technical literature. A University of Texas study has shown 1.2 tons of carbon per acre per year were sequestered using this approach. A Colorado State University study showed 3 tons of carbon per acre per year were sequestered using this approach. And the North American estimate is 0.8 billion tons or 800 million tons of carbon can be sequestered in soil through proper grazing management. That's per year. My own calculation is that Vermont could be capturing 290,000 tons of carbon per year on the pasture lands that it already has using proper grazing management. So I strongly push against the less meat argument, but I stand with the elimination of CAFO argument, but not the elimination of meat. We need to just change how we produce meat, and if we produce it in this regenerative way, it is a very powerful climate solution.
A new study that came out in the journal Science called Reducing Food's Environmental Impacts Through Producers and Consumers said that even the most sustainable meat operations were not as healthy for the planet as some of the least sustainable vegetable operations. So could we, Seth, move from meat and animal products into vegetarian products, you know, vegetables and other plant-based food, and still, you know, do the soil work you're talking about and benefit the planet?
No, that narrative is wrong. And I want to be clear about that. We have to restore approximately 10 billion acres of degraded pasture land around the world. And to do that requires changing the management, but there must be a demand for grass-fed meat. And so we need to be clear about the distinction between, you know, the cheap meats that you get at the supermarket that you know are produced in CAFOs and they're fed soy and all those deleterious indicators that's a legitimate problem, but there's an entirely new methodology evolving, and we need to be championing that methodology. And so I'm strongly advocating against the narrative that says reduce meat. No, we need to eat the same amount of meat, maybe even more. We need to reduce calories from carbohydrates and sugar, but we should be getting calories from good meat. And here in Vermont, there's the Vermont Grass Farmers Association. I'm honored to be on the board of that group. There are 100% pasture-raised meat farmers in Vermont, and they need our help. They need our support. We need to be taking a lead in this movement. I understand the emotional and the historical background to be vegetarian. I was a vegetarian myself for 12 years. But there's a new narrative now. There's new science. And we need to be getting with the program, so to speak, of embracing the type of agriculture that's actually going to draw carbon out of the air. It's not enough to minimize our impact or to lessen the impact. We're past the point where that's going to do any good. We have to remove approximately 280 gigatons, billion tons of carbon out of the air. The only place it can go is in soil and trees and other biomass, and most soil in the world is in pasture land. So this is actually an essential strategy for a safe climate.
Professor Niles, you're listening to this. Where do you come in on this conversation?
Well, I completely agree with Seth that we have amazing opportunities in agriculture to support farmers to do these kinds of practices. Certainly looking at soil carbon and its storage in soils has been a huge and growing focus of research, and there's a lot of potential there. I think my point is that we also have other options around food waste and other things that should also be on the table as well, but I completely agree and want to support also the efforts that are happening here in Vermont and beyond for acknowledging the work that farmers are doing to sequester carbon. You know, on the food waste side of that, I think the thing that is so troubling to me is if farmers like the ones that Seth works with and farmers across Vermont are going through all of these practices and all of these transformational changes, and then we're getting things on our plate and we're throwing them away, it's all for nothing, right?
Seth, we got a question a few minutes ago from Dave that we posed, who wrote in saying, you know, people aren't going to go vegetarian or vegan even if we said they should. They're not doing it for health reasons. They're not going to do it for the planet. So in addition to what you're talking about here with soil restoration, do you see a practical side as well for, you know, this is the diet that people seem to want?
Well, obviously, it just comes down to the practicalities of daily life. And the more options there are for people to buy grass-fed meat, and the more it's appropriately labeled. I mean, my vision is that there will be labels in the future which actually tell what the carbon footprint of the product is. And if you're in a supermarket or somewhere and you have a local grass-fed meat product where the soil is being sampled by the Extension Office at the University of Vermont, and they can show that the carbon is increasing in that pasture, and next to it is a block of tofu made from soybeans grown in Iowa on what should have been tall grass prairie, there's not going to be any comparison. The more climate-responsible choice by far is going to be to buy the local grass-fed meat.
That's Seth Itzcan, co-founder and co-director of Soil for Climate, a Vermont-based nonprofit that advocates for soil restoration to help reverse global warming. Seth, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. It's my honor.
Meredith Niles, I mean, what about that? Is labeling going to help us through this for consumers who really want to be informed and want to be making good choices, maybe agreeing with Seth that, you know, meat may still be the way to go, but it's all about how it's being produced? I mean, can we get to that kind of really good labeling?
Well, per your commenter's call earlier, a lot of people don't make decisions based on the environment, unfortunately. And we actually have had carbon labels that have been in place. They've been in place in certain countries around the globe within the past 10 years. For example, in the UK, they did a bunch of carbon footprinting, put CO2 labels on foods, and generally people were confused by them. You know, they don't really know what an equivalent of CO2 looks like. So I do think if we are going to move in a labeling direction, first of all, we have to acknowledge what segment of the population has the ability and the choice to make purchases in that way? And two, how do we create them in a way that's really transparent and helps people truly understand what that means?
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're exploring the question of how what we eat affects global climate change and what you can or should be doing about changing your diet. Our guest is Meredith Niles, professor in the Department of Nutrition and Food Sciences in the Food Systems Program at UVM. And as she's been telling us, it's a whole food systems approach here. So we're talking not only about what land is being used for animal and plant production, but also how it's produced, how it's transported, how it gets to us, what we do with it, how much we waste. I mean, there's a lot to talk about when we think about how what we eat is affecting the globe and the climate, and then how we can change our decisions and what we might need in terms of extra help from the government or from producers to know what choices to make. Lot to digest here. Our number, if you'd like to share your thoughts, is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your comments on the VPR Facebook page. Let's go to Rani, who's calling in from Colchester. Hi, Rani. Go right ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
My name is Rania. I'm calling from St. Michael College. I'm an international student from East Timor.
Yeah, and what are your thoughts? What are you thinking about?
I am just surprised that when I came here for the first time, I see the amount of food that the student eats, like a lot of meat with like a big chunk of mashed potato, just potato, without like vegetable or rice. It's just totally different than my diet back home, and it's just shocking to me.
Rani, thank you very much for calling. So Rani from East Timor comes to St. Michael's College and thinks, oh my gosh, Americans are just eating so much. Professor Niles, is that something that we should also be thinking about? I mean, for our waistlines as well as for the planet?
Yeah, I'm glad the caller brought that up. I mean, again, there's a lot of things to consider here. So not only what's on your plate, but also your portions. So if we're overeating and there's calories being consumed that aren't necessarily important for our basic metabolic functions and to lead a happy and healthy life, then those are also having an impact as well. So it's another component of this to think about from the climate perspective, both what we're eating, but also how much we're eating.
I want to bring another voice in here, too, because we're talking a lot about what choices we make to eat. And a lot of the articles that you read right now say go vegan or go meatless. And it's all about meat, 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 meat. So, you know, if you are a meat producer or, you know, a cattle rancher, I guess, in Vermont, what do you do and how do you think about this? Mark Cesario thinks about it a lot. He's co-owner of Meeting Place Pastures, a grass-fed beef farming operation in Cornwall. And Mark's on the line with us now. Hi, Mark. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for taking my call.
So, Mark, I know you think about this. How do you say, yes, what I'm doing as somebody who is a beef farmer, you know, I'm raising cattle for beef production, but I'm also thinking about the planet. How do you weigh what you're doing and how it affects the globe?
So I think that actually the what I call myself is actually quite important to sort of the end result. And so actually, when I don't actually view myself as a beef producer, you know, I view myself as a land manager. And so, you know, I think to eat meat or not eat meat is kind of a reductionist mindset. And so in trying to take a holistic mindset, sort of I, as a land manager, in first trying to sort of have it, you know, harvest solar energy and then just move that energy through, you know, the carbon cycle, the nutrient cycle, the water cycle. And when I'm taking those things into account as a land manager, often the byproduct is meat, you know, and we are here in Cornwall, Vermont. I am in designated state grassland, and this land grows grass. And I think too often grass is sort of overlooked as a wonderful conservation and a climate mitigation tool because it's just ubiquitous. And so, you know, I think that change just for me, if as me of a beef producer to a land manager, then changes the result that I'm having on the land. And so I, in wanting to prove that I'm doing what I'm saying to do, a Middlebury College student, Kate Porterfield, a couple of years ago worked with us to develop a study to try to figure out how much total carbon was I sequestering in the soil. And so we started farming here in Cornwall in 2009. We started with 100 acres. We've grown that to almost about 1,000 acres now, and every year we've taken on a new piece of ground. And so Kate was able to look at our soil samples each year and then be able to understand how that related to our management and how many years under our management, you know, that piece of ground was on, and then try to look at the increase in soil organic matter every increase in year that we've managed property. And on the land that we've managed for 10 years, you know, we've increased our total carbon in the soil by about 150%. And and the surprising thing was that increase in total carbon happened at deeper soil profile. So not just in the 0 to 5 inch layer, but from about 5 to 30 inches layer. And so that carbon down there is locked away and sequestered. The carbon in the top layer of the soil is kind of being, you know, eaten up by microbes and can be sort of released back into the air. But the deeper you get that down, that's locked in there for a long period of time. And that's all about root depth. And so when I'm managing, you know, my above-ground livestock, I'm really thinking about the below-ground livestock and the roots. And the deeper the roots, the deeper that liquid carbon pathway is to sort of put that carbon deep in the soil and lock it away.
So Mark, though, then, is beef production a necessary evil to make enough money to do the grass farming that you talk about? I mean, you're still producing and selling meat. So, you know, that must be part of the equation.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm not sure if I would view it as a necessary evil, but yes, the meat is often the byproduct of the land management, and because, you know, I'm using grass as a tool for soil health and soil to increase carbon. You know, we don't eat grass as human beings, but cows do, or any ruminants do, and so, you know, the ruminants are just moving that solar energy through the cycle and turning it into, you know, a product that we can then eat. So, you know, what is, I think on the ethical side, what is really fascinating is that actually if you were to weigh the total microbes in the soil in a given acre, it actually could equal the same weight of 2 steers. So, you know, if I'm actually creating an environment where more life exists underneath the ground than almost above the ground. And so, yes, one animal may die in the situation where you eat, you know, beef from that steer. But I've created 2 steers worth of life underground in trying to just, again, think about soil health and carbon sequestration. So, yeah.
That's Mark Cesario, co-owner of Meeting Place Pastures, again, a grass-fed beef farming operation in Cornwall. Mark, thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you for having me.
So, Meredith Niles, we're looking at all of these different ways and people talking about labels, people talking about different ways that we should be doing it. A couple more emails coming in. Bill and Warren says, I would argue that the single greatest thing a person could do to reduce their impact to the climate is to not reproduce. Drastic, I know, but with every new human comes a new consumer. So, I mean, that's part of it, how many people are on the globe and how much food we need to produce. Clay says, vegan or meat eater, you will still have a mass production problem to feed the masses unless people kill their own meat and grow their own vegetables. The problem is still there. And we also got a note from Sarah who says, Fair Food Forager is a great website and app that allows consumers to consciously choose places to buy food. These places have made earth-conscious choices that allow them a lesser negative impact on climate change. Some examples are compostable takeout bins, using only local organic products, or forbidding single-use plastic. And again, the website she mentions is Fair Food Forager. One other thing that we probably should address here too, Professor Niles, is cost. I mean, we think about the ethical choices we make often cost more than the less ethical choices. Cheap meat is really cheap. If you want to buy organic vegetables or vegetables that have cost more to produce, they cost more to buy. And same with grass-fed beef. So when we look at equity and how people can feed themselves, you know, money is going to be a big part of it, isn't it?
Yeah, money is going to be a big part of it. And also part of that has to do with who's paying the cost, right? So we have these price points at, you know, the grocery store, but the cost of things at the grocery store is not the ultimate cost that the environment or our globe will pay, right? So there are a number of things that we do subsidies-wise and other government programs that could reconfigure some of these price points. There's also incentives incentive programs that could help farmers do more of what Mark is doing, for example, sequestering that carbon, changing the cost structure. But I completely agree with you. If we're talking about food security, an issue I also work on, we really have to do think about the costs of these things. But I think there's great opportunity to reorganize some of our structures so that we have in place systems that capture the environmental costs of things that we're actually looking at.
What would that look like?
Well, I think it would, first of all, involve shifting subsidies or shifting policies towards production practices that have environmental benefits or outcomes. So there are other countries that do that. There's also been calls for just eliminating subsidies at sort of a more global level to equalize some of the price points that could be in existence because of those subsidies. So, for example, right now the Farm Bill is up in Congress. And so the Farm Bill is the bill that really sort of dictates what food and agriculture looks like in this country. And that could be re-envisioned to help farmers like Mark shift towards different kinds of practices.
And we're planning to do a Farm Bill show on Thursday. So as long as all things go well, you can tune in on Thursday to listen to a show more about the Farm Bill and what happens with the expiration of the 2014 Farm Bill. So we started the show with the question, should I stop eating meat? Should I go vegan? Should I stop eating animal products altogether? If I'm listening to this whole show, I may be more confused now than when I started, when I tuned in. So, you know, what is the answer?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's because we dealt with a complex topic, and I really appreciate that VPR wants to do that, first of all. So I think there's a number of things that we have to consider. You know, in the short term, do the things that you can do right now that help your household. To me, that's food waste reduction. I think if we start there, we can eliminate a lot of production that is not going to be utilized, which helps minimize greenhouse gas emissions and helps us also deal with our growing population problems and distribution, et cetera, right? So let's use what we actually make now. And I think that is really tenable for the average person because it also helps them save money. You know, my concerns about these black and white, you should stop eating meat or you should always eat meat is that there's really behavior-wise, I don't think it's going to be feasible. The whole world is not going to become vegan unless barring some crazy unforeseen circumstances. Like I said earlier in the show, we're really talking about sort of a 30% diet shift that the average person is willing to make. So if you find this conversation useful and you want to continue to eat meat, then think about those grass-fed options. You know, local as well can help reduce the transportation emissions. So I think those are options. But I also want to impart that I think we really do need multiple solutions here. All of the most recent research really suggests that we need farmers like Mark to implement those practices, and we need people to stop wasting food, and we should also think about what we're consuming and what might be on our plate. So we should really be doing all of these things if we actually want to get to that 1.5 degree world that the IPCC talked about.
That's Meredith Niles, a professor in the Department of Nutrition and Food Sciences in the Food Systems Program at UVM. Thanks very much for walking through all of this with us.
Thank you so much.